But Second Chronicles chapter 18 and verse 1 reads, Now Jehoshaphat had riches and honor in abundance and joined affinity with Ahab. Our theme this evening is a sinful alliance, a sinful alliance. Our chosen company says a lot about us, and those we willingly join forces with says a lot about us too, as to how much we rejoice in the Lord and trust Him in all things, as opposed to leaning to our own understanding. The Lord had abundantly blessed Jehoshaphat, as chapter 17 tells us very clearly. But there is a tendency in the child of God, because of indwelling sin, to not be content with such things as we have, even when we have them in abundance. And it is a feature of sin working in the heart that we not only want more when we haven't much, but even when we have much, we still want more. And so it was with Jehoshaphat. The first thing we look at is facing reality about apostates. Facing reality about apostates. Verse 1, Now Jehoshaphat had riches and honor in abundance and joined affinity with Ahab. There was affinity in the marital sense between Jehoshaphat and there was a natural affinity between Judah and Israel, but also there was a marital connection between them. And we find that Jehoshaphat's was maritally connected with Ahab. Chapter 21 and verse 6, And he walked in the way of the kings of Israel, like as did the house of Ahab, for he had the daughter of Ahab to wife, and he wrought that which was evil in the eyes of the Lord. So Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, married a daughter of Ahab. And Ahab was one of the worst kings Israel ever had, and his wife Jezebel was certainly no better. As a princess from Tyre, she had introduced hitherto unknown forms of idolatry into Israel. Jehoshaphat should surely have known the position. He should have known that Ahab was an apostate. In chapter 19, the next chapter in verse 2, Jehu says to Jehoshaphat, Shouldest thou help the ungodly and love them that hate the Lord? Jehoshaphat should have known that Ahab hated the Lord. Instead, he was easy prey for Ahab. Jehoshaphat got further and further into the mire. And he refuses to face reality about Ahab. And that does happen. That because of ties of one kind or another, there is a reluctance in the child of God to face reality when it is clear what the position of the other party is. And so it is something we should watch against, is deliberate naivety, if that isn't a contradiction in terms, a deliberate unwillingness to face reality about someone who is clearly an apostate from the Lord. And it was the case that Jehoshaphat should have realized what Ahab really was. Secondly, the next step in compromise. Verse 2. And after certain years, he went down to Ahab to Samaria. And Ahab killed sheep and oxen for him in abundance, and for the people that he had had with him, and persuaded him to go up with him to Ramoth Gilead. And Ahab, king of Israel, said unto Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, wilt thou go with me to Ramoth Gilead? And he answered him, I am as thou art, and my people as thy people, and we will be with thee in the war. Ahab made a fuss of Jehoshaphat. He slew sheep and laid on everything for Jehoshaphat and those who were with him. His true intention was to entice Jehoshaphat to help him in the struggle to take Ramoth Gilead. This was a town that was meant to be part of the inheritance of the tribe of Gad. It was 28 miles east of Jordan and only 62 miles south of Damascus, the capital of Syria. And he was determined to take it back again. Instead of smelling a rat, Jehoshaphat made ecumenical noises. Verse 3. And Ahab, king of Israel, said unto Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, wilt thou go with me to Ramoth Gilead? And he answered him, I am as thou art, and my people as thy people, and we will be with thee in the war. I am as thou art. But he wasn't. He wasn't the same as Ahab. Ahab was a wicked idolater. And yet he's saying, I am as thou art. And so we can see how Jehoshaphat is engaging in gross wishful thinking, in pretending that the bond with Ahab was there when it wasn't. And so there was a shared ancestry, and Israel, like Judah, was of the tribe of the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But in heart, there was a difference between Jehoshaphat and Ahab, and between a lot of the people. A lot of the Israelites were content to worship at the golden calf. Not all of them. There were those who joined themselves to Judah. But perhaps Jehoshaphat thought, well, Ahab, at least he isn't a pagan. He was worse than a pagan. He was an apostate. And apostates are worse than pagans. Because of the sin against light. An apostate professes the truth and yet hates it, and that becomes evident. And that's worse than never having known the way of righteousness. Thirdly, unease is not enough. Unease is not enough. Verse 4 to 13. Verse 4 reads, And Jehoshaphat said unto the king of Israel, Inquire, I pray thee, at the word of the Lord today. Believers can feel uneasy in a compromised situation. Better to feel uneasy than to feel nothing. But it's not enough. And Jehoshaphat did seem to feel uneasy in this situation. He belatedly suggested seeking the mind of the Lord. He'd more or less committed himself already. But then he says, well, should we not inquire of the Lord? As a kind of afterthought. And maybe he was looking for reassurance that he wasn't really going against the word of the Lord. He does not object when the false prophets put on a fairly obvious show. Verse 5. Therefore, the king of Israel gathered together of prophets 400 men and said unto them, shall we go to Ramoth Gilead to battle, or shall I forbear? And they said, go up, for God will deliver it into the king's hand. This was obviously a performance. These were the false prophets who sat at Jezebel's table, 1 Kings 18:19. And their function was to reinforce public confidence. That's what they were there for. To, not as real prophets, but to put a cosmetic veneer on things and to give a certain religious aura to Ahab's decisions. They knew what they were paid for and they did the job. And so they simply said what they knew King Ahab wanted. Jehoshaphat's unease surfaces, but not strongly, not as it should have done. It surfaces in his request for another prophet. Verse 6, Jehoshaphat said, is there not here a prophet of the Lord besides that we might inquire of him? There were these 400 prophets. They say, well, I'm not satisfied. He evidently knew fine well that these men were not real prophets of the Lord. And he was saying, is there a real one? Doesn't quite come out with it like that. But when Ahab expresses his hatred for Micaiah, he demurs somewhat at the end of verse 7. And Jehoshaphat said, let not the king say so. Don't say that. But even yet, he's still not facing reality. Ahab hates the Lord. And the reason he hates Micaiah is because he declares the word of the Lord. But what can we say about Micaiah? He was despised, we know that. He was also alone. He was sent for while Zedekiah and the others were performing their charade in verse 10. And Zedekiah the son of Chenera had made him horns of iron and said, thus saith the Lord, with these thou shalt push Syria until they be consumed. And all the prophets prophesied so, saying, go up to Ramoth Gilead and prosper, for the Lord shall deliver it into the hand of the king. While they were performing, Micaiah was sent for. And the position was told to him, verse 12, and the messenger that went to call Micaiah spake to him, saying, behold, the words of the prophets declare good to the king with one assent. Let thy word, therefore, I pray thee, be like one of theirs, and speak thou good. The messenger tells him what's going on. All these prophets are saying, go up to Ramoth Gilead. Don't step out of line for your own good. But verse 13, and Micaiah said, as the Lord liveth, even what my God saith, that will I speak. He was determined to be faithful to the Lord. Resolved even though he was already despised of Ahab, even though he knew that what he was to say in the Lord's name was the opposite of the 400 prophets and the very thing that Ahab didn't want to hear. Today, ministers do not receive direct revelation from God. We have that. We have divine revelation, the Bible. But they are to declare what the Bible teaches without regard to anything else. And they are to declare what the text of God's holy word actually says. But Micaiah was outstanding in his readiness to swim against the tide, to go against the 400, to give the king the message that he didn't want, because it was the word of the Lord. Fourthly, truth and error. Truth and error, from verse 14 right down to 27. In verse 14, "And when he was come to the king said unto him, Micaiah, shall we go to Ramoth Gilead to battle, or shall I forbear? And he said, Go ye up and prosper, and they shall be delivered into your hand." Some people think that Micaiah faltered at this point, but it's more likely that he spoke sarcastically, that he's saying, this is what the 400 are saying, okay, you go up. You go up and see. And it seems that's the way he was speaking, because of Ahab's response. He obviously knew that Micaiah wasn't speaking in a normal, straightforward way. The king said unto him, "How many times shall I adjure thee that thou say nothing but the truth to me in the name of the Lord?" It's hard to imagine a more hypocritical statement. He knew Micaiah was being sarcastic, but he still tells him that he wants to know the word of the Lord. But he didn't. It was the last thing he wanted. And he pretends that he does want the word of the Lord. It's a terrible thing to pretend to want to know what God says when we don't. Israel would be like a flock without a shepherd. In other words, without a king. The kings were often called shepherds. And they would be scattered on the hills, verse 16. In other words, they would lose the battle, they would be scattered, and the king would be killed. Then Ahab still complains when Micaiah tells him the truth. Verse 17, "And the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, Did I not tell thee that he would not prophesy good unto me, but evil?" He's just said to Micaiah, "Don't mess about with me, tell me the truth." He tells him the truth, and then Ahab complains bitterly against him. But what was going on behind the scenes? Micaiah now describes this in verse 18 to 22. Verse 18, "And again he said, Therefore hear the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting upon his throne, and all the host of heaven standing on his right hand and on his left. And the Lord said, Who shall entice Ahab king of Israel, that he may go up and fall at Ramoth Gilead? And one spake, saying after this manner, and another saying after that manner." Now, here we have God's sovereignty over the angels, good and bad. That even the wicked angels can do no more than God permits. God's sovereignty does extend over the angelic world, and though he is not tempted of any man, nor tempts any man, Yet God governs in providence the outworkings of human sin and of angelic sin, the sin of the fallen angels. That's why the angels who kept their first estate are called elect angels, because the reason they kept their first estate was because God chose them to that end. Evidently, even a sinless being needs the power of God to remain sinless. And in the book of Job, the sons of God appear before the Lord, and Satan seeks divine permission to afflict Job in various ways. This is telling us that even the actions of the evil angels are governed by God. He so restricts and restrains and hems in the actions even of wicked angels, even of the demons, that they can do no more nor less than God has ordained. And the same is true of wicked men. Shimei cursing Joseph, cursing David, said that David says the Lord had bidden him. Joseph's brothers meant it for evil when they sold him as a slave, but God meant it for good. The Lord Jesus Christ was taken, according to the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God, by wicked hands and crucified and slain. Acts 2, verse 23. So God's providential decree is here represented as if it were a command for our benefit. God's decree is represented, it's the same in the book of Job, as a command so that we can follow what is going on. And in verse 20, then there came out a spirit and stood before the Lord and said, I will entice him. And the Lord said unto him, wherewith? And he said, I will go out and be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets. And the Lord said, thou shalt entice him, and thou shalt also prevail. Go out and do even so. Now therefore, behold, the Lord hath put a lying spirit in the mouth of these thy prophets, and the Lord hath spoken evil against thee. There is a terrific boldness in Micaiah as he declares plainly that the false prophets are liars and that he is declaring the truth. The result is persecution. Verse 23, then Zedekiah the son of Chenaanah came near and smote Micaiah upon the cheek and said, which way went the Spirit of the Lord from me to speak unto thee? And Micaiah said, behold, thou shalt see on that day when thou shalt go into an inner chamber to hide thyself. That is the idea of going into an inner chamber to seek refuge from the oncoming foe. And then further persecution in verse 25 to 26, Ahab puts him in prison and says, he'll stay there till I come back in peace. And Micaiah says, if thou wilt at all come in back in peace, certainly, then the Lord has not spoken by me. In other words, you won't. You won't come back. Jehoshaphat continues. It is as if he's in a stupor. He has been plainly confronted with truth and error. He has been confronted with Micaiah telling the truth of the Lord and the false prophets and Ahab, and he sides with the wicked. Do you know that does happen? genuine believers get it wrong and side with ungodly people even. It does happen. And that's what's happened with Jehoshaphat here. Fifthly then, stupefied by compromise, but not utterly forsaken. Stupefied by compromise, but not utterly forsaken. Verse 28 to 32. Verse 29. And the king of Israel said unto Jehoshaphat, I will disguise myself and will go to the battle, but put thou on thy robes. So the king of Israel disguised himself, and they went to the battle. It's obviously a trick. It's obvious. Whether he flattered Jehoshaphat and said, well, you take the prominent role, I'll just disguise myself and keep a lesser role. You take the limelight. But it was obvious that the one who was a king, and obviously a king, was going to get attacked. Anyone could see that. Why didn't Jehoshaphat resist? Well, because compromise makes us stupid. And once begun, we don't know where to stop. And Jehoshaphat goes along with this self-evidently deceitful trick of Ahab. But the Lord has not given up on Jehoshaphat. Verse 31. And it came to pass when the captains of the chariot saw Jehoshaphat this, that they said, it is the king of Israel. Therefore they compassed about him to fight. But Jehoshaphat cried out, and the Lord helped him, and God moved them to depart from him. For it came to pass that when the captains of the chariots perceived that it was not the king of Israel, they turned back again from pursuing him. The Lord heard him and helped him and moved them to depart from him. The Lord had not cast off Jehoshaphat. He corrected him. He chastened him. But Jehoshaphat could say in the end, with us he dealt not as we sinned. And it was the Lord who moved them to depart from him. The wrath of man shall praise thee. The remainder of wrath shalt thou restrain. And God restrained the fury of the Syrians so that they turned away from Jehoshaphat. Sixthly, God's judgment sure. God's judgment sure. Verse 33. And a certain man drew a bow at a venture and smote the king of Israel between the joints of the harness. Isn't that a marvellous picture of God's providence? The man drew a bow at a venture. He was just firing towards Israel. But God had so governed that he would draw his bow in just the direction that the arrow would not only hit Ahab, but hit him in the vulnerable space between the joints of the harness. When God has planned to save, he can certainly do it. When he's planned to judge, he can certainly do that too. He'll not lack means to bring judgment upon the wicked. Even down to the detail, he worketh all things after the counsel of his own will. And so Ahab stayed up in his chariot until the even, and about the time of the sun going down, he died. What can we learn? Firstly, even good men stumble. Even good men stumble. Peter compromised, and Paul had to rebuke him to his face in the book of Galatians. Good men do stumble. Secondly, the Lord chastens, but does not forsake his stumbling saints. What a blessing to know that. Doesn't mean we should be complacent about stumbling, but it does mean that the Lord will not cast off. Because we falter and fail, we should not despair, but turn again to the Lord. Thirdly, God's sovereignty over the details. Even over the details, he is sovereign. Where an arrow flies and where it hits, where the chariot men would go, all of these things, everything, every detail is in the hand of the God of providence. And then fourthly, compromise needs to be nipped in the bud. Compromise needs to be nipped in the bud. We do not need to become foolish fanatics, but real compromise needs to be stamped on early. First sign of losing our first love and being unwilling to be at odds with the world when necessary, mortify it. The further we go into it, the further we have to come back, the more painful the recovery will be. The first sign of decaying zeal for the honour of the Lord, mortify it. Kill it. Put it to death. Follow the Lord fully. And may our path be as the path of the just, that shineth brighter and brighter unto the perfect day.